So let's have our post-presidential US presidential election panel. And joining us for this right now at RCR is Marie Buskey. Hi, Marie.
Hey, Paul. How's it going?
Not too bad. It's been exciting. Kind of.
Yes.
Last couple of days, really, but particularly today, which is just at the end of the day before now when it's playing. Did that explain it all right?
Well, let's put it this way. Yes, it is in the early evening, and I have a house full of people who are also quietly and hopefully optimistic.
Yeah. Okay. And William McGimsey is with us. Hi, William.
G'day, Paul. G'day, Marie.
Hey, how's it going, William?
Good.
All right. So it seems, as we're talking right now, that it's a win to Trump. Who wants to kick off?
Yeah, so it's looking likely. It's looking likely. So we're at about 6 p.m. on New Zealand time on election day. And I'm just looking at the sort of the New York Times predictor, and they have Trump at about 89% chance of winning right now. And
okay.
Oh, they've moved it to 91, actually. I just literally was just checking
the states that have been called. So Trump's on sitting on 230 electoral votes, and Kamala Harris is on 204. In terms of the states that have already been awarded, so the important states of Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, and maybe Georgia. New York Times hasn't called Georgia yet, but I think the state officials from Georgia are saying.
Others have. And I think he lost in Georgia, by 100,000 votes? What was it? To Biden, 12,000 votes in 2016. So there you go.
Yeah, so it's all looking quite likely here. I guess the important states that are still in play are Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Arizona. Those would be the big ones. And I think all of those are leaning towards Trump as we speak. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah, Pennsylvania alone gets him over the line, though, as I understand it, as we're talking right now. And I saw some analysis not too long ago that showed that Kamala, and that was about an hour ago, would have to get 65% of the vote there to do it. And I mean, that's just good luck with that, you know.
Well, and the New York Times, too, are also predicting a Trump to get 301 college electoral votes to Harris's 235. So they're obviously picking that blue wall to crumble and fall. And Arizona is currently sitting on a coin toss at the moment. So, you know, as we speak now, so it is looking good. And Pennsylvania, too, they counted the absentee and postal and early ballots this time round. I don't know whether you guys remember last time, but he had a 15-point lead before they stopped the counting. And one of the things I've really noticed this time around compared to 2020, being a pandemic election, is obviously the impetus from all those officials who were running elections was to run a tight ship that was efficient to get numbers across to actually give people confidence in the vote that was going forward. I mean, this time in 2020, it was still an absolute dog's breakfast. A small amount of the vote was counted. There were absentee ballots left, right, and centre. Whereas, you know, you're calling battlegrounds now. At the time of recording, 6 p.m. Here in New Zealand. Whereas it was still, we all went to bed at 11 o'clock last time, and they were still very up in the air.
In the morning.
Much more certain this time.
There was that graph.
The other one too, William, I'd love to get your view on this as well. Just before I came in here and sat down, Fox News called that they were flipping the Senate, and Chuck Schumer, if that's the case, is going to be out.
I heard that too. So that means if all these results hold, and other things could still change, but what's looking likely at this stage is you have a president, a Senate, and a Congress all in Republicans' hands, so fully powered up, fully operational Trump administration coming in.
Let's assume that as we're talking now, it pans out that way. He wins. Boy, what happens? What happens now? Do you think?
Well, I have to say, Paul, your interview that you did with Trevor was fantastic. And the one thing that I really didn't appreciate, actually, until you spoke to Trevor, was the fact that in 2016 he didn't expect to win. So he didn't have a transition team in place. So what he did is, and he had to cobble that together. And he's been very open about the fact that he didn't have good people around him in 2016. He made some poor decisions, and that led to a lot of the issues, even though he achieved so much in 2016 from the list of things he wanted to achieve. This time round, different story. I don't think he'll make the same mistakes.
There's been a lot of talk about the importance of getting your people into the bureaucratic positions. And so there's been a lot, there was a lot of talk about Project 2025. And although they can that, I still think that there's a lot of knowledge and drive and desire within the Trump camp to make sure that they're getting their ideological opponents out of those positions of power within the bureaucracy and putting their own people in so they can sort of steer the ship.
We have issues here regarding that still, don't we?
Yes.
The overhang.
Yes. Yes. The other number two for me that's quite interesting is traditionally what often will happen is that a Republican will get across with the college seats but don't win the popular vote. If you look at the New York Times, they're predicting him to win it by 1.1 points. So that sets a really interesting mandate because there has been grumblings among certain Democrats that they may not ratify and certificate the election. It's a difficult thing to do when you if you win the college seats and win the popular vote.
They sort of used the fact last time that when Trump won, that he didn't win the electoral college to try and delegitimize his victory. And then, of course, you had a whole lot of people coming out saying, you know, well, we don't believe in the electoral college. We think it's anti-democratic. We think it should the presidency should just be awarded in terms of who wins the popular vote. So I think those arguments will go away. I think it's good for the American electoral college, and it's good for the if all these results hold, it will be good for the legitimacy, and hopefully Americans can sort of unify around. It's probably a bit optimistic, but unify around in the new administration, and they can actually get some things done.
Is this the most incredible political comeback in the history of, I don't know, it's stunning, isn't it?
Yeah, they were saying it was the greatest since 1968.
Yeah, but you took a bullet.
He's been impeached how many times? Twice, three times? And he's been had two assassination attempts. Yeah. He's got all the media and institutional power arrayed against him. It's a sensational story.
How do the TDS sufferers handle it? That's the thing I'm really fascinated with. You know, will their heads literally explode en masse? And what does that mean? And I wonder what it means for us too. That's another thing I'm curious about.
Well, so I've got a friend who's just watching the coverage for me, and he just texts before for the Harris campaign coverage, and he just texts saying the Harris campaign just shut off all the sound on the TVs at the watch party, replaced with music after a guest on CNN said that tonight felt more like 2016 than 2020. The crowd has significantly thinned, and the mood is feeling seriously downcast.
Reminds me of Hillary, right? She remember in 2016 she didn't turn up for about 2 hours, and there was talk that she was out the back drinking.
Well, I think Carla, that's her modus operandi, isn't it? I think she's rather fond of a fermented beverage. So it wouldn't half surprise me that she's already pretty spaced. Will she? I mean, we will know this potentially. I mean, this will air and it'll all be over by the shouting. But one of the conversations we were having with the crew before I came in here is, if they call Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, so it's there, will she concede? Will she actually go out and concede?
I saw some people recommending that Trump, within a certain time frame, no matter what, should come out and claim victory. And that was on an hour or two timeline about half an hour ago. So that some people are that confident to say that.
Well, in 2016, I remember that didn't happen. Hillary didn't concede until about, I think, 10:30 at night. And it was about 11 o'clock before he came out and gave a speech, New Zealand time.
Yeah.
The way we're tracking this time, I mean, we could all know by 9 p.m.
Yeah.
Here. I mean, they've already called California and all those West Coast states, so they've already put them in the mix. And the only ones that have been that are essentially outstanding, hold the phone caller, are Arizona and Nevada. Hasn't even started counting yet.
Someone's suggesting they could swing to Trump as well, but it's traditionally never been that way.
Well, Clark County, I mean, they were the ones that took, weeks
that's right.
last time
Thanks for reminding
to get
me.
Their result in. They were hopeless. Yeah, exactly. So Nevada hasn't even started counting yet. Arizona is on a knife edge. Wisconsin, Minnesota's the other one, actually. Minnesota is tighter than they expected. Obviously, that's where Tim Walz is from, so it's fairly safe that it will go blue. And they've called Hawaii, and it's pretty safe to say that Alaska's going to they'll call that for Trump.
How do you think New Zealanders are going to react to a Trump victory?
Well, I think if you look at the polling, most New Zealanders support Kamala rather than Trump.
Yeah.
The other important issue to consider here is the tariffs Trump said he's going to put on. So that potentially affects some of our trading relationships and our economy. And it will be interesting to see how that all plays out domestically and economically in New Zealand and with our politics and how that affects.
Do you mean in relation to China, William?
No. If Trump's promising to put tariffs on a whole bunch of countries, I don't think it's targeted at China.
Okay.
He wants to, the idea is to encourage.
Well, but our relationship
will affect
anyone who sort of does biz with China.
So it'll affect us economically. So.
I had dinner last night with someone who owns a global food company, and he is very concerned about a Trump win just from a business perspective. He said it will be a bit ouchy, particularly for Fonterra, because he said whilst we believe that a lot of our milk products go up to China, he said a massive amount does actually go across to the United States. And the other one is also the wine industry. You know, we do sell a lot of wine into the US. Dairy is interesting. They produce dairy, but not potentially to the levels that they require in the US, whereas wine, they got plenty of wine over there. So I think our Sauvignon Blanc producers may find that it will be a little bit of an ouchy landing for them in terms of tariffs. But I think, look, I look at this from a cultural war perspective. For me, having the ability to have leadership that will actually redress the imbalance of the culture war scales on the Western Hemisphere is massive. It's been imbalanced for so long now. And in a way, it gives a tacit approval, an unspoken tacit approval for people to actually be a bit stronger.
Permission.
And stand up and say, no, we're having enough. Yes, and they just say, no, we've had enough of this now. And it's beginning to happen. And I think this will actually help push things a little bit over the edge and hopefully redress some of the absolute madness that has been going on in the cultural space. I mean, look at the new Green MP that was sworn in today. Good. I mean, could we virtue signal
at
any
every
harder?
Every item of virtue signaling clothing I've ever seen anyone wear.
Oh, my Lord. Between the skirt and the tea towel over the arm and the beret, I was just like, oh, good night, sweetheart. You're tragic. God, I was actually, I was thinking, where's Darlene?
Yeah. I think that's right. Like, one of the most lasting influences Trump is going to leave on not just the American political scene, but the whole global and Western political scene is the influence he's had on the political conversation. He embodies sort of political incorrectness in a way, not in a really brutal way. It's almost as if he doesn't understand political correctness. He wouldn't he talks as if he couldn't even figure out how to say the politically correct thing if he wanted to. And so his mere presence has opened up a lot of areas of conversation that were previously off limits. And I think that's a really good thing for democracy. If we want to have a proper democracy, we need to be able to have conversations about a whole range of topics. If you have whole areas of policy off limits for public discussion, how legitimate is your democracy really? So that's, I think, one of the really good effects that Trump has had.
Now, just I'm a bit ignorant on this. Because he's had a previous term, but a term in the middle, it still means he can only have two terms, right? He can't Yeah, so that's how that works. Correct. So everything that he needs to do to set things up the way he's been talking, he's got to do in the next 4 years. That's it.
Yeah, and if he actually gets the Senate, which is they're now calling it that he will, and they should, at this stage it's projecting he should still hold on to the House.
Yeah.
Watch out.
Freight train.
Watch out. There will be absolute freight train. Oh, here we go. I've just been sent something now. Yeah, it's looking. It looks like they have called. They've now called two out of the three in Nebraska have now been called, and he's also got picked up one in Maine, and the other they're calling for the Democrats. So it's ticking along.
All right, then. Of course, there are the wars. Netanyahu fired or parted ways with his defense minister in the last 24 hours or so. It'll be interesting to see the Trump effect on the conflicts. Have you done any thinking about that, guys?
Well, one of the really good things about Trump's last term, and one of the things that people really appreciated about it, was the fact that he didn't start any new wars, and that went down really well. But I think the great fear this time round is that he's sort of, there are hints there that he might get involved militarily with Iran, weigh in on the side of Israel and against Iran. And he's actually come under criticism from what would otherwise be allies on his right. The groupers, so to speak, have been criticizing him for that. So that's something worrying to look out for. And I mean, I hope that doesn't happen, but it could very well.
Anyone who's endorsed Kamala Harris and Tampon Tim, they call him, kind of have to eat their words now. It's sort of cringy, isn't it?
Oh, they'll make up a new reason, Paul, for what has happened. I mean, what they're already starting to talk about excuses. So one of the ones I heard literally just before we came here was the fact that the Democratic machine was saying they didn't have enough chance to get her out in front of the voters and introduce her to the voters.
She was there.
She's the vice freaking president, totally. For goodness sake. How much
elected her
does she need?
Ever.
Well, I think that's actually coming.
I think her public appearances, really, I'm not sure that really the problem was she didn't get out in front of the voters enough. But many of her public appearances or interviews, she sort of bombed and didn't do very well at all. There's the famous Brett Baer interview, and then she didn't do very well in her town hall meeting, being questioned by Anderson Cooper. So she's got a sort of, sometimes she displays what appears to be a lack of knowledge of the issues she's commenting on. She also has a sort of funny way of talking that
cackling.
Yeah, well, there's the cackle, and then there's she makes these really general statements that she tones as if they're really profound things.
A lot of nasal,
yeah,
I've noticed.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of breathing through your nose or whatever. One thing that Elon Musk said in the Rogan podcast last day or so, apart from, you know, turning to the camera and saying you got to vote, and he was like as serious as I've ever seen anyone talking, and that was kind of quite powerful. But another comment he made, I think with Rogan agreeing, that mainstream, this is the line where mainstream media now dies. As a force, it's no longer
relevant.
You don't need it to win an election anymore. So that says something, right?
Well, in the past, people used to compete for the endorsements of newspapers, and this time around, they've been competing for the endorsement of Joe Rogan. So Joe Rogan has an audience now that rivals many big newspapers.
Bigger.
Yeah, that's right. And it's not just him. There's a whole sort of global industry now of podcasters, independent media providers, you know.
Well, we're moving into that space in a way as well. You know, we've got a foot in that camp as well. But the power of it now can't be questioned.
Oh,
absolutely not. Yeah, absolutely not. And these are the parallel structures. These are the parallel structures that will actually help dismantle what is the sort of neo-Marxist type and sort of ideology, almost cultish behaviour that has happened over the last sort of 15 years, that is now slowly being dismantled because people have just like from a media perspective, quietly switched off and gone elsewhere.
Well, our politicians need to take note of that, don't they? Basically, I think I can confidently sit here and say to any who are listening, you need us now, because that's what that means in my mind. Maybe not immediately, but morphing into that now from this moment if Trump is the winner, because that proves it. You don't need mainstream anymore. You could almost be going backwards, actually, by, you know.
Well, I think mainstream media or legacy media needs to actually get back to being. It's what Bezos said in his letter, his open letter around not wanting to endorse a candidate. And they need to actually get back to being the fourth estate, to actually doing their jobs. And there has been this absolute slippage in their reporting and their partisanship, really, for what, more than a decade now, but especially since 2016. If they do their jobs right, they're going to have another great 4 years, because, I mean, Trump is there, so they're going to have to report on that. I mean, they will love it, because they do well when he's in office. So for them, this is a great thing, but they need to get back to what they need to do properly, because they know that independent media is now standing alone. People don't trust them. They've got, what, trust figures of like 25% or something in the US currently. It's tanking. So either they realise and have a, you know, have their little pity party, which they'll do for the next little bit, probably until the, you know, January 6th, and then get over themselves and start doing.
Many governments are really worried about this. They're worried about the fact that the public opinion is no longer sort of bounded within these large media organisations. That the conspiratorialism and so-called violent extremism, which isn't really violent extremism, it's just opinions they don't like, are now getting out of hand, because you've got all these alternative media providers giving people different opinions and different ideas to chew over. So I think that's why you're seeing, like in Australia, for example, the big clampdown on misinformation. You're seeing that in Europe. We had that in New Zealand under the Ardern government. So this type of thing is still going on.
Okay, I'm coming up against time. So if we look back over this campaign in the US presidential campaign, it's kind of bizarre in a way, isn't it? Because of Biden pulling out, that horrible performance in that debate, Kamala coming in, almost like a coup. And then there was Trump with the vest and the garbage truck. And there's been obviously the assassination attempts. It's been incredible. What do you, any idea on the defining moment, or isn't there one? It's just a cumulative set of.
Well, there was a whole lot of iconic and photogenic moments. So if you remember back to the mugshot photo of Trump, and then you remember to the iconic photo of him standing up after being shot with blood streaming down his face, fist in the air, the iconic McDonald's photo.
Yeah, that's right. RFK wouldn't have been a fan of that, I don't think.
Anyway. Say what you want about him, but he's good at managing the aesthetics of the campaign, and it's one of the most well-managed aesthetic campaigns that I think I've ever seen. He's just great at producing those iconic moments and those iconic.
Well, he's an entertainer. Part of him is an entertainer, right, really?
Yeah. And the other thing he did too is he delegated really well. He pulled together a team around him, this incredible team of leaders of their own around him, and then delegated out a lot of the campaigning to them. So you saw Turning Point with Charlie Kirk and Vivek Ramaswamy going into colleges. I reckon a lot of that young vote would have been swung by them. You had RFK Jr. and pulling him into the fold, Get America Healthy Again. So all of those voters who would have been independent to him or undecided have actually pulled them into the fold. Tulsi Gabbard, you know, and all of them did their own town halls. And J.D. Vance, I'm sorry, I'll say it again, I'm a massive J.D. Vance fan. And I think he, as a VP pick, was just brilliant.
That's the thing about him. And that debate
against Walz, look at the airtime they got on that. He eviscerated Walz in that debate.
Yeah. You can't remember to say all those things. They're organic, right? You can sit there and learn as many lines. As soon as something unanticipated happens in the script, you got nowhere to go. Not that guy.
And in this campaign, he, by doing that, by delegating that and actually having this team around him, it actually means that it's more than just one man. Whereas her campaign was, they tried to build the entire campaign around her.
I was going to say, a whole cottage industry of Trump explainers and Trump interpreters has sort of popped up in the wake of this sort of cultural phenomenon that is Donald Trump, and sort of explained intellectually the ideas that Trump sort of grasped and explained intuitively to the American audience. And J.D. Vance is probably the one of the chief people in that category. And he's the vice president now. So there's a sort of succession plan. So that
that's a good point.
The Trump administration is leading a sort of ideological reformation of the Republican Party, and also of, arguably, of if they're successful, of Americanism, the American idea, in a way, not a complete reformation, but a change in sort of focus. And they've got this a whole coterie of new people. They're going to be putting new people into the bureaucracy, and they've got J.D. Vance there, willing to take over the reins when things finish off. So if they're successful in doing this, they will have changed the ruling ideology, so to speak, and that would be a significant achievement if they could pull that off.
I'll just be pleased not to see Rachel Levine ever again.
She's the Admiral, right?
Yep.
Yeah, I've seen a few memes with him in there. I'm just wondering, we have an election, 2026, and obviously a successful campaign, like we've just, assuming that it all goes well as predicted for Trump, a successful campaign. I wonder, of our crop of parties and politicians, who would benefit most from emulating that kind of positioning, that kind of campaign style? I would have thought New Zealand First.
Yeah, well, they're the closest sort of comparative party, sort of civic and economic nationalist type party, looking more at building up your own sort of infrastructure, building up your own domestic industries, rather than focusing so much on gaining wealth through trade. So, and actually they're announcing a whole bunch of policies, their recent party conference, a whole bunch of those type of very Trumpian economic policies came out of it. But it's not really fair to call them Trumpian policies, because Winston's been doing this for 30 years. He was doing it before Trump came.
Yep. Yep. Marie?
Yeah, I'd agree. I'd definitely agree to that. And it's that permission. I think it's that permission, as we have to, as voters and constituents, actually take back what it is that we want. I think we've been, in this country, too nice. And
kind.
We've just sort of let things go. And the experiences I've certainly had in the last few years, I've gotten to a point that I think we need to bring a little bit of disagreeableness back.
Yeah, bit of grumpiness.
And no is actually a perfectly valid answer to a great number of questions.
Yeah, well put. Have you seen the video of Tulsi Gabbard with her husband singing the song about rainbows? Have you seen that?
Wow. No.
Women are going to fall in love with him, I'm telling you.
Well, I know plenty of men that have fallen in love with her, so.
Yep. All right, any final comments before we end this? It's a pre-recorded panel.
Well, I'm talking to Marty at Absolute Sparrow's Fart tomorrow morning for Media Matters, which will go out just after lunch. So him and I are literally doing that extra early so we can at least get the results in overnight. So that's where I'm going to be at with Media Matters tomorrow from 1. So hopefully we'll have more results in, and potentially a final result. We'll know where we're at.
I might listen or tape Radio New Zealand tomorrow just to see how they're coping with it. Would that be an idea, William?
Maybe. It's good. Gumboot Fridays just happened. They'll need the money for the mental health support.
Yeah, well, market share increases for Mike King potentially. Any comments to sign off on, William?
Well, it's been an incredibly dramatic campaign, as we've been talking about. He's been impeached twice. He had his mugshot taken. He's had survived two assassination attempts. And even then, the polls were neck and neck, and it's come right down to the wire. And it looks like he's pulled it out. He's slightly outperformed his polling, and he's gonna take it out. So, great. It's great theatre. And
Brilliant theatre.
But also, I think, very important. It signifies something important. For a long time, people have felt that there's been sort of, you've had a uni party. And Trump, he is something a little bit different that had sort of been excluded from the American mainstream for a while. And his victory now, the second victory he's had, signifies change, real change, I think.
All right. William McGimsey and Marie Buskey, thanks for coming on for this.
Thanks.
You're welcome, Paul.